A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I was reading about this and just sat there for a minute thinking about the sheer scale of it. 34 million homes. Daniel's prompt this week is about lead paint. He wants us to bring the same lens to it that we've used for other environmental hazards. The one where a genuinely dangerous substance, through education and mitigation, becomes manageable rather than terrifying. He's asking why lead was ever in paint, what made it dangerous, how it parallels things like asbestos, what it actually means to live with it under layers of modern paint, and why we'll never see a mass eradication in our lifetime.
And I think that last part is the thing that makes people uncomfortable. The idea that we just live with it, not because we're ignoring it, but because the alternative is tearing apart a third of the country's housing stock.
So let's start with the part that seems baffling in retrospect. Why would anyone put lead in paint in the first place?
It wasn't a mistake. Lead paint was a superior product by the standards of its time, and by its time, I mean for most of recorded history. Lead pigments gave you colors that were vibrant and didn't fade. Lead-based drying agents made paint cure faster and harder. Lead additives resisted moisture and mildew. If you wanted paint that lasted, you wanted lead. The Romans were using lead compounds and pigments 2,000 years ago. It wasn't some industrial age shortcut.
It was the premium option.
Lead carbonate, what they called white lead, was the standard white pigment for centuries. Lead chromate gave you brilliant yellows and oranges. Lead tetroxide gave you that deep red-orange you see on old barns and bridges. These weren't cheap fillers. They were the good stuff.
Which makes the psychology of it trickier, right? It's easier to be angry about something that was a corner-cutting cost saver. This was the opposite.
And the scale of what we're dealing with now is staggering. According to HUD and CDC data, about 34 million homes in the U.S. were built before 1978, which is when lead paint was banned for residential use. That's roughly 35% of all housing stock. Most of those homes still contain lead paint somewhere. It's just buried under layers of non-lead paint.
34 million. And that's just residential.
Just residential. Schools, commercial buildings, bridges, all of that's on top. And here's the key distinction from asbestos that I think a lot of people miss. Asbestos fibers can become airborne just from aging and deterioration. The material gets brittle, it crumbles, fibers float into the air. Lead paint doesn't work that way. It doesn't become dangerous through aging alone. It becomes dangerous through disturbance.
Say more about that.
The paint sitting intact on your wall, under three layers of latex, is essentially inert. The danger comes when someone sands it, or when a window frame rubs against its jamb and creates friction dust, or when a door slams and chips the paint on the doorstop. That's when lead particles enter the air and settle on surfaces where children can ingest them. The mechanism is mechanical, not chemical decay.
So the paint isn't leaking poison into the room just by existing?
Correct. And that's the first misconception most people have. They imagine the walls themselves are emitting something. They're not. The hazard is dust, and dust comes from friction or demolition.
All right. So let's get into the chemistry of why this stuff is dangerous in the first place. What's lead actually doing in the body?
Lead is a neurotoxin that mimics calcium. That's the short version. Your body has transport mechanisms designed to move calcium around, across cell membranes, across the blood-brain barrier, into bone tissue. Lead is chemically similar enough that it hitches a ride on those same pathways, so it crosses the blood-brain barrier and interferes with synaptic development. In children, even blood lead levels below 5 micrograms per deciliter, which is the CDC's reference level, are associated with reduced IQ and attention problems.
Below the reference level.
Below it. There's no known safe threshold. None. Every bit of lead in a child's bloodstream is doing something undesirable. The CDC's reference level isn't a safety cutoff. It's a statistical trigger for public health intervention. They look at the distribution of blood lead levels in children and set the reference level at the 97.5th percentile. It's a way of saying this is unusually high compared to the population. Not below this, you're fine.
That's a distinction that gets lost in every news story about lead.
Every single one. And the exposure pathway in a home with intact lead paint isn't the paint itself, it's dust. Friction on window sashes creates fine lead dust that settles on windowsills and floors. Young children put hands in their mouths after touching contaminated surfaces. Soil around foundations can be contaminated from exterior paint that weathered over decades. The paint on the wall isn't the problem. The dust from the window is.
So, the window is the thing to watch.
Window replacement is the single most effective lead hazard control measure. Studies show it reduces dust lead levels by 60% or more. Because windows are the primary friction surface, they move, they rub, they generate dust every time you open and close them. A wall just sits there.
Which means a lot of people are living in homes where the walls are fine, but the windows are quietly generating a hazard every day and they don't know it.
And they don't know it because the paint looks fine. That's the second big misconception. You can tell if paint contains lead by looking at it. You can't. Lead paint looks identical to non-lead paint. The only way to know is testing. XRF analyzer or lab analysis of a paint chip.
XRF being?
X-ray fluorescence. It's a handheld device that shoots X-rays at the paint and reads the signature of the elements that bounce back. It's non-destructive, it takes about 30 seconds per reading, and it tells you immediately whether lead is present and at what concentration. These used to be $15,000 instruments that only industrial hygienists owned. They're now available for rent at some hardware stores, and some home inspectors offer lead testing as an add-on service.
So the technology to know is getting cheaper, but most people still don't know.
Most people living in pre-1978 homes have never tested. They assume the walls are fine because the walls look fine.
Let me pull us back to something Daniel was getting at, the parallel with asbestos, because I think there's a useful framework here.
Both are what I'd call legacy hazards. Substances that were once considered beneficial are now known to be dangerous, but are so embedded in existing infrastructure that removal at scale is impractical. Both are managed through encapsulation, sealing, rather than elimination. Both require education over panic.
And the difference is?
The big one is the exposure pathway. Asbestos fibers are carcinogenic through inhalation, and they remain dangerous indefinitely. A fiber that's been sitting in ceiling tile for 50 years is just as hazardous the day it's disturbed as it was the day it was installed. Lead paint's danger is primarily to children through ingestion, and intact paint is essentially inert. The second difference is who's at risk. Asbestos-related diseases primarily affect workers with occupational exposure, miners, construction workers, shipbuilders. Lead paint's primary victims are children under 6, because their brains are still developing and because they're the ones putting dusty hands in their mouths.
And the parallel in terms of public response?
Both inspire a kind of visceral fear that often outstrips the actual risk in a given situation. People hear lead paint and want it all removed immediately, the same way people hear asbestos and want full abatement. But in both cases, the safest and most cost-effective approach is usually to leave it alone if it's intact, encapsulate it if it's at risk of disturbance, and only remove it when renovation or demolition makes disturbance inevitable.
The EPA's Renovation, Repair, and Painting Rule, the RRP rule, requires certified contractors for any work that disturbs more than 6 square feet of lead paint in pre-1978 homes. But here's the weird part. The rule doesn't require testing.
That's the perverse incentive. It just requires assuming lead is present, so a contractor can either test and know, and then be legally obligated to follow lead-safe work practices, or not test, assume it's there anyway, and also follow lead-safe work practices. But if you test and find lead, you've created a disclosure obligation that follows the property. If you don't test, you just do the same work under the assumption rule, and nobody has to write anything down.
So ignorance is cheaper than knowledge.
In terms of paperwork and liability, yes. Which means the regulatory structure actively discourages testing. That's not a bug in the rule, it's a compromise. The EPA knew that if they required testing, compliance would crater. So they built a system where the work practices are mandatory regardless of what you know, and testing is optional.
It's a very American solution. Do the right thing, but don't create a paper trail that might cost someone money later.
I'm not sure I'd call it the right thing, but it's the thing we've got.
Let's talk about the peak of the lead exposure problem, because paint was only half the story.
Leaded gasoline was the dominant source of environmental lead exposure in the 20th century. Tetraethyl lead was added to gasoline as an anti-knock agent starting in the 1920s, and for 50 years we sprayed lead particles out of tailpipes across every city in the developed world. Paint was the second major vector. But here's what's interesting. Gasoline lead is gone. The last country to phase it out was Algeria in 2021. That's done. The airborne lead from gasoline has fallen by something like 98% in the US since the phase out. But lead paint remains in the built environment indefinitely.
So we solved the easier one.
We solved the one where the solution was stop adding it to the product. With paint, the product is already on the walls. You can't just issue a regulation and make it disappear.
Which brings us to the question Daniel really wanted us to wrestle with. If it's so widespread and so dangerous, why are we tearing it all out?
Money. Full abatement, stripping all lead paint from a home, averages $8 to $15 per square foot. For a 2,000 square foot house, that's $16,000 to $30,000, and that's just interior walls. Exterior paint, windows, trim, all extra. Encapsulation, which is painting over with specialized sealants, costs $3 to $6 per square foot. Neither is covered by most homeowners' insurance.
And the federal programs?
The HUD Lead Hazard Control Program has remediated about 200,000 homes since 1993, out of roughly 34 million pre-1978 homes, that's 0.6% in 30 years. At that rate, it'd take about 5,000 years to get them all.
So we're not going to.
We're not going to. It's not a question of political will or public health commitment. The math simply doesn't work. The only practical path is management, not eradication. Know where it is, keep it intact, encapsulate it when it's deteriorating, and use lead-safe work practices when you renovate.
Which sounds reasonable until you think about the information asymmetry problem.
Right. Homebuyers rarely test for lead paint unless they have young children. Sellers are required to disclose known lead hazards but aren't required to test. So most people living in pre-1978 homes don't know whether they have lead paint. And they often assume they don't because the walls look fine.
And the people who are most likely to be in rental properties with deteriorating paint are the least likely to have the resources or the leverage to demand testing.
That's the environmental justice dimension. The EPA's 2024 proposed rule to lower the dust lead clearance standards from 40 micrograms per square foot to 10 on floors reflects growing recognition that previous thresholds were too high. But enforcement is inconsistent, and rental properties are the least likely to be tested or remediated. The families who need the protection most are the ones least likely to get it.
40 to 10 is a big jump.
It's a recognition that the old standard was essentially saying, this much lead dust is fine, when no amount is fine. The 10 microgram standard is still not zero, but it's a lot closer to what's achievable with proper cleaning.
You mentioned earlier that lead paint wasn't banned because it was known to be dangerous. What actually drove the ban?
The health effects were documented for decades before the ban. Childhood lead poisoning was described in the medical literature in the 1890s. The lead industry fought regulation aggressively. The Lead Industries Association was essentially the tobacco industry playbook before the tobacco industry wrote it. They funded research that downplayed the risks, marketed lead paint for children's furniture and toys, and successfully delayed regulation for decades. The 1978 ban came after a long fight driven by advocacy groups, pediatricians, and eventually class action litigation.
It's the same story every time. Industry fights the science. Science eventually wins. But the product is already everywhere.
And we inherit the cleanup. Every generation inherits the cleanup from the previous generation's superior products.
Let's talk about what it actually means to live with this stuff. The practical reality.
If the paint is intact and not generating dust, the risk is negligible. That's the starting point. The danger comes from three things: renovation without proper precautions, natural deterioration on friction surfaces, and, this is the one people don't think about, repainting without proper prep.
Repainting sounds like the safe thing to do.
It is, if you do it right. But if you sand the old paint to get good adhesion for the new paint, and you don't use wet sanding and containment, you've just created a lead dust hazard where none existed before. The act of covering it up can be the dangerous part.
So what does doing it right look like?
Wet sanding, keeping the surface damp so dust doesn't become airborne. HEPA vacuums for cleanup. Plastic sheeting to contain the work area. No eating or drinking in the work zone. And ideally, testing first so you know what you're dealing with.
Which is encapsulation, essentially.
Informal encapsulation. The specialized encapsulants, products like Lead Defender or Fiberlock, are thicker, more durable, and certified to seal lead paint for up to 20 years. They require proper surface preparation and regular inspection. But a few layers of good latex paint over intact lead paint is functionally similar for a wall that nobody's going to chew on.
The chewing part isn't a joke, by the way.
It's not. Lead acetate has a sweet taste. Historically, children would chew on lead-painted windowsills and crib rails because they tasted good. That's part of why the pediatric exposure numbers were so horrific in the early 20th century. The paint was literally candy-flavored.
That's...
Yeah.
The generational shift in how people perceive this risk is interesting. You've got baby boomers who grew up in houses full of lead paint, probably chewed on some windowsills, and many of them are skeptical that it's a real danger. Then you've got millennials and Gen Z who grew up post-ban and tend to be more cautious, sometimes to the point of anxiety.
The reality is somewhere in between. The risk is real but manageable. The boomer skepticism comes from survivorship bias. I turned out fine, but that ignores the statistical nature of the harm. Lead doesn't poison every child who's exposed. It shifts the distribution. A few IQ points here, some attention problems there, across a population of millions. You don't see the damage at the individual level unless the exposure is severe. You see it in population-level outcomes.
And the millennial anxiety.
Also not entirely rational. If you're an adult living in a home with intact lead paint, and you're not sanding the walls or licking the windowsills, your personal risk is essentially zero. The danger is to children, and it's primarily from dust, not from paint. A home with intact lead paint and modern windows isn't a hazard. A home with deteriorating lead paint and old friction windows is.
Which is a much more nuanced message than lead paint bad.
And nuance is the first casualty of public health communication. Lead paint is dangerous, is true, but incomplete. Lead paint is manageable if you understand the exposure pathways and take basic precautions, is more accurate, but doesn't fit on a brochure.
Let's talk about the global dimension, because this isn't just a U.S. problem.
The U.S. banned lead paint in 1978. The EU banned it for most uses in 1992. But according to the World Health Organization, as of 2024, only 48% of countries have legally binding limits on lead paint. In many developing nations, lead paint is still sold and used in residential settings.
So half the world is still putting it on walls.
Still manufacturing it, still selling it, still painting nurseries with it. This isn't a solved problem. It's a deferred one. The global phase out of leaded gasoline was a massive public health victory. It took decades, but it happened. The global phase-out of lead paint is maybe halfway there.
And in the meantime, we're adding to the legacy stock that future generations will have to manage.
Every gallon of lead paint sold today in a country without regulations is a future abatement problem that someone will have to pay for.
You mentioned the Lead Industries Association earlier. I want to go back to that for a second because I think it illuminates something about how we got here.
The playbook was simple, and it's been reused many times since. Fund research that creates uncertainty about the harm. Market the product aggressively to vulnerable populations, in this case, children. Delay regulation by arguing that voluntary standards are sufficient. When the science becomes undeniable, pivot to arguing that the problem is misuse, not the product itself. The Lead Industries Association was doing all of this by the 1930s.
And it worked for 40 years.
It worked until the epidemiological evidence became overwhelming and the civil litigation started succeeding. The same pattern played out with asbestos, with tobacco, with PFAS. The substances change, but the strategy doesn't.
There's something darkly funny about the fact that lead paint was marketed as being safer, because it was durable and washable. Which is true, it was, and that very durability is why we're still dealing with it a century later.
The thing that made it a good product is the thing that makes it a persistent problem. It doesn't degrade, it just sits there.
All right, let me try to synthesize what we've covered. Lead paint was a premium product that made sense given what people knew at the time. It's in tens of millions of homes, It's dangerous primarily to children through dust ingestion, not through the paint itself. Intact paint is essentially inert. The practical approach is management, not eradication. Encapsulation, window replacement, lead-safe renovation practices. And the biggest gap is information. Most people don't know whether they have it.
And the biggest policy failure is that the people most at risk, renters in older housing stock, have the least ability to do anything about it.
Which is where I keep coming back to the testing question. As portable XRF analyzers get cheaper, and they are, some home inspectors now offer lead testing as a standard add-on. We might see a shift from assume it's there to know it's there, and I'm not sure whether that helps or hurts.
It's a real question. On one hand, knowing where the lead is lets you target your mitigation efforts. Replace the windows that have lead paint, not all the windows. Encapsulate the friction surfaces, not every wall. On the other hand, knowing creates a disclosure obligation that can affect property values and make it harder for low-income homeowners to sell.
Knowledge has a cost.
Knowledge has a cost, and our regulatory system sometimes punishes people for acquiring it. That's a bad incentive structure, but fixing it's politically difficult because nobody wants to be seen as weakening lead disclosure requirements.
The broader takeaway for me is that our built environment is a palimpsest of past decisions. Every building is a physical record of what people knew and valued at the time it was built. We can't erase every mistake our predecessors made, but we can understand them, respect the skill of the problem, and make informed choices about how to live with them.
And the most important choice is usually the least dramatic one. Don't panic. Test if you're going to renovate. Replace the windows if you can. Keep the paint intact and the dust down. The boring stuff.
34 million homes.
Hilbert.
I worked a summer in 94 stripping lead paint off Victorian houses in San Francisco. Before the RRP rule existed, before anyone took it seriously, we used heat guns, which vaporize lead into inhalable particles, and dry sanding, which creates clouds of lead dust. Nobody wore respirators. The foreman would hose down the plastic sheeting at the end of the day and call it wet cleanup.
Heat guns. That's the vaporization temperature for lead is well within heat gun range.
We didn't know. Or we didn't ask. The foreman said it was fine and we needed the paycheck. I remember coming home with white dust in my hair every day. My roommate made me shower in the basement.
And you're fine?
I'm 48 years old and my blood lead level is probably fine. And that's the weird thing. We did everything wrong, and most of us are okay. But that's survivorship bias talking. The guys who got really sick aren't here to tell us about it. The danger is real, but it's slow and statistical. It doesn't hit you like a car crash. That's why it's so easy to ignore.
The latency and the probabilistic nature of the harm make it almost perfectly designed to be dismissed.
I still have the heat gun, in a box, in the garage. I've been meaning to test it for lead residue for 30 years, and never have.
30 years.
It's probably fine.
The heat gun itself is probably coated in lead dust that's been sitting there since 1994.
I should probably throw that away.
Yeah.
The thing I think about now, though, is the houses we worked on. We were stripping lead paint so they could be repainted. The owners wanted fresh paint. They paid us to create a hazard so they could have a different color dining room. And we did it in the least safe way possible because nobody told us there was a safer way and nobody was required to.
That's the information problem in a single anecdote.
The paint was under control until we showed up.
I think that's the thing that sticks with me. The hazard isn't the paint on the wall. It's what we do to it.
Anyway, that heat gun's been in 3 different garages across 2 states. I keep moving it because I think I might need it someday. I've never needed it. I don't even know if it still works.
The encapsulation approach, but for tools.
I guess so. Don't touch it. Don't disturb it. Move it carefully when you have to.
The question I keep coming back to is whether more testing actually helps. As the XRF analyzers get cheaper and more home inspectors offer lead testing, we're going to go from a world where most people assume they don't have lead paint to a world where more people know they do. And I don't know if that knowledge leads to better outcomes or just more anxiety and lower property values.
It leads to better outcomes if it's paired with education about what the knowledge means. If you learn you have lead paint and the response is panic and a $30,000 abatement quote, that's bad. If you learn you have lead paint and the response is okay, the walls are intact, let's encapsulate the friction surfaces and replace the windows when we can afford it, that's good.
So the knowledge is only as useful as the framework for interpreting it.
Which is exactly what Daniel was getting at in the prompt. The best safety mechanism is education and awareness. Not because education makes the leak go away, but because education tells you what to actually worry about and what to leave alone.
We'll be right back with some final thoughts.
Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Props. If you want to hear more about the hidden hazards in the places we live and the weird, pragmatic ways we deal with them, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.